This meeting was scheduled to start at 10 o'clock. I think we'll wait for another 5 or 10 minutes. We seem to be getting a lot of people still coming in, and we'll let them clear the traffic jam at the front door a little bit. So if you'll just bear with us, we'll be starting right away. Thank you. One, two, three, one, two. I believe we will get the session started. There are still a few people coming in, but we'll move on. I'd like to welcome you to this session. I'm Temple Newman, session chairman. This is session 10, Future of Medical Information Systems. I've been asked to make an announcement relative to the cards you got when you came in the front door. These are questionnaires giving your views of the way the Westcon sessions are operated. We'd like to remind you that to please fill these out and return them at the door as you leave so that the next year's session of Westcon can be even better. This is the way we have of getting feedback from you on your views. I'd like to welcome our speakers this morning. I will defer until just before each of the speakers gives a paper for a more detailed introduction, but I would like to welcome them to this meeting, thank them for being available to share with us the experiences they have had in developing and using medical information systems. Just a word about the structure of the session. There will be four speakers. Following each speaker's paper, I will open the floor to one or two short questions specific to that paper. If you can keep these rather short and specific, then if you will defer any other questions to the end of the session, if we can stay on schedule here, we should have 30 minutes at the end for a general question session. I know the speakers have indicated that they will be glad to field questions from the floor at that time. I'd like to make one comment relative to a semantic problem which sometimes arises in discussions of this particular subject area, and that is the difference between medical information systems and medical electronics, or what I would like to call instrumentation systems. And in spite of the little symbol that was printed on the program, we are talking about the former. We will not be talking about pacemakers or electrocardiograms. So if some of you have wandered in expecting that, be advised, we will be speaking about medical information systems today. The speakers will be addressing the area of medical information systems in the context of the hospital. I'd like to point out that where this is the area in which most of the work of this type has been done up to the present time, the concepts which they will be talking about have a much wider application than just in the hospital setting. For example, in the areas of multiphasic testing or in the areas of industrial medicine, for example. The theme for this session is really two-part. The first part I would like to address in the few minutes I have allocated to myself in an introduction and takes the form of a feeling of urgency, I believe, that the healthcare delivery system faces at the present time. The second portion of the theme has to do with the lessons which have been learned from practice in applying information systems in the healthcare delivery field. And the speakers will be addressing this portion of the theme. If I could have the first slide, please. This slide presents a recent history and some a number of projections of the demand for health care in the United States. The historical portion of the graph, running from 1950 to 1970, has a number of very interesting aspects to it. The very rapid increase in total expenditures in the last few years, the absolute value of expenditures, which in 1970 amounted to approximately $70 billion. I might point out this is exclusive of the of medical education. This is just directly health care expenditures. The interesting ratio between the government expenditures and private expenditures, we can see that the business is still very largely, the industry is still very largely a private industry. But we can see changes taking place in that in this point. Another very important factor here is the fact that this is the population line, actual here, projected here, that the increases are not really very much affected, not very sensitive to population growth, nor even to the growth of gross national product. Up here we can see the expenditures for healthcare delivery as a percentage of gross national product, running from 4.6% in 1950 to 7%, an increase of 50% overall in those 20 years. This is the very spectacular one, the per capita cost of medical care running from $80 per person per year in 1950 to $345 per year in 1970, and all indications is still going up. Well, these are the historical picture. I don't want to dwell too much on those. What I would like to do is move on to some of the projections which we have put on this chart. The projections on the right-hand side here are the normal kinds of projections that one always makes when you do a study of this type. No one believes them, really, but yet they're rather interesting to put on there and look at. Projection 1 and 3 have to do with the projection of costs as they relate to just the growth of the population base itself. Number 1 representing a continual expenditure at the per capita rate in 1970 on out through 1985, and that's the kind of curve you get. If we look at the rate of change of expenditure per capita in 1970 and project that on out, we get a curve that looks something like projection 3. And projection 2 and 4 are similar types of projections related to the gross national product. So that we see that at least these upper curves, tend to indicate that the expenditures will probably tend to cause that curve to continue to move out in an upward direction in the years to come. Now the interesting projections on this curve, I believe, are 5, 6, and 7, the ones on the left here, and these have to do with actual projections with actual legislative programs which are being considered by Congress at the present time, or at least being talked about. There is a change, I believe, taking place in the attitudes within the country and within Congress relative to the health care delivery system in the United States. These come about from a number of factors. They come about from, I believe, an honest concern about the well-being of the health care delivery system. They also come about from a change in social attitudes. We hear comments of the nature that good health is not a privilege, it's a right of everyone and should not be limited by the limitation to pay for health care. And of course, when you get these kind of factors operating, we also get a very large political interest in these things, and so that the political entities and the legislative entities in our country are now focusing very, very much on the health care field. Specifically, the projections that are shown here, projection 5, is the one for the AMA-sponsored Medicredit program. This is probably the most conservative of the national health insurance programs that have been proposed, and is projected to cost something like $15 billion a year. The projection number six is the one that has been sponsored by Senator Kennedy and others, and is estimated to cost by Senator Kennedy's figures $55 billion per year. The Nixon administration says that number is likely to be more like $77 billion per year. And the last projection, number seven, is the bill sponsored by Senator Jacob Javits, and that bill tips the scale at something like $68 billion a year. We can see that the magnitude of these particular programs are of the same order of magnitude of the present expenditures of health care of $70 billion per year. Now, we have added these projections directly on top of the present health care expenditures. Now, that is admittedly in error, but we don't know where else to put them. It is clear that programs like Medicredit are going to be, maybe to a very large extent, the alternative ways of paying for medical care, which is now already provided, so that maybe that curve will shrink. On the other hand, if we believe the social implications of this political and legislative activity, which we talked about previously, then we can see that just providing an alternative means of paying for existing medical care is not really what is wanted, is not really the driving force behind this kind of thing. What is really of interest here is to extend the payment of medical care to a larger population, to those people who cannot now afford it. And in fact, taking the Senator Javits situation, Medical Economic Magazine, June 1970, quoted Senator Javits as saying that after review by the Bureau of the Budget, their estimate was that no more than a few percent of his total bill of $68 billion would represent a duplication of existing payments for medical care. What does this mean now in the net result? It seems to me that, first of all, I'm not attempting to say that any one of these programs will become fact or that any one of these projections is the right projection. What I am simply trying to say here is that in toto, the activities that are represented by these various projections indicate that a significant increase in demand for medical care is a very likely prospect. Now, the next question immediately comes to mind as to what are the resources with which we can meet that increased demand if, in fact, it does occur. And I would like to just quickly run through three main areas of resources which we have to meet these demands. The first one, next slide please, shows the historical availability of medical doctors in the United States. We can see there's been a slow increase in the total number since 1963. We can see, however, that the doctors actually engaged in patient care has not increased all that much, that those engaged in administration and research and so forth has increased at the same time, so that the net availability of doctors for patient care has not increased. And the doctor-to-population ratio, while it's bounced around here quite a little bit, is not all that much different than it was back in 1963. There are a number of factors being discussed to alleviate this problem, shortening the academic schedule in medical schools, building new medical schools, use of paramedics, all of these kind of things. I think that the conclusion to be drawn from this curve and the preceding one is that the time scales are off, that the solutions that are going to undoubtedly come about, all of these and others that I haven't mentioned, to alleviate this problem may come about, but may come about too late to or out of phase with the increase in demand. Next slide, please. This shows a similar picture for the nurses, which is not nearly so bad. We have a nicely increasing curve of nurse supply, and it's projected on out here, if we can believe these HEW projections. However, there's a generally acknowledged shortage of nurses today, represented by this gap, and according again to the HEW estimate, that projection is indicates that it's going to widen as time goes on, that it's going to get worse instead of better. Now, if we have the last slide, please. This one shows the situation relative to the hospital. This is a rather interesting curve to me, at least, not being a hospital administrator or a doctor. The indication here of total hospital beds available in the United States. While it was a slow increase in the total number, actually some decrease here at the end. However, we must recognize that there are a number of factors at work here. The older hospitals are taken out of service or replaced by new, more modern facilities, which is a significant difference. And also there's some change in the stay time of people in hospitals in general, and at least or in some categories, the stay time is going down. But nevertheless, I think we can see here that over the last 20 years, there's been a continual decrease in the per capita availability of hospital beds in the United States. All of this, we have the slide off, please. All of this leads us simply to the conclusion that there is no large reserve of resources available to meet any near-term large increase in demand. And I think that's the message you want to stop with at this point. And this leads me to the conclusion of this portion of the introduction, which is I want to set the stage here that we are in a time of urgency, I believe. I think the solutions, whatever they are, must be started and completed soon. Now, in finding these solutions, I think that the next point that must be taken up, and is the second part of the theme of this session, is that these solutions must grow from prior practice. We cannot afford to make the same mistakes that were made over and over again. We cannot afford to attempt to bring solutions to this area that are based upon fallacies that have existed because possibly we in the electronics business have not understood or do not realize the needs or the problems that exist in the medical community. And this leads me directly to the theme of our first speaker. I asked Dr. Lamson to open this session on the future of medical information systems and ask that he set the theme for the session to reflect not only this urgency that I have spoken of, but also those experiences, both good and bad, which he has lived through, both as a developer and a user of computer-based systems. I have particularly asked that he not shirk from expounding those views, which may in some way go counter to some of the established sacred cows of the information systems business. He's assured me he will do that. As I have tried to point out, there is much more at stake here than the preservation of a theoretical science or a proprietary product. Dr. Lamson received the AB degree in physics from the University of California, Berkeley, and his MD degree from the University of Rochester, New York. He has held many staff consulting and academic positions in government, private hospitals, and the University of California. In 1962, he was appointed professor of pathology at UCLA, and in 1966, he was appointed director of all UCLA hospitals and clinics. He has done extensive research and publication in the fields of clinical laboratory and hospital management, and in natural language storage and retrieval systems for medical diagnostic data. Dr. Lamson.
Thank you, Mr. Newman.
Our topic today is primarily one of communication among humans. And in order to get off to a start here, is there a physician in the house? One. Are we mostly an audience from the physical sciences, engineering, physics? And on the podium here with me, I see several more physicians who I've sat on the stage with before. Sometimes they get first crack at this, and I have to pick up the pieces when they're through. This time I get a chance to set the stage a little, and then they can, I'll provoke them if I can, and then they'll have a chance to tell you where I'm wrong so we can have an interchange here. We have been at this business of attempting to bring improved methods of communication, including automation techniques that are computer-based, in the health industry now for about 10 years. At the beginning, the prospects appeared to be superb, and there were large sums of federal money and some very major commitments from private industry made in order to exploit this opportunity. It did appear at that time, and it still does appear, that in an ideal world, wherever we're dealing with sick people, whenever any information becomes available to those who will care for those people, it should be recorded in some form of database. It would accumulate over time in some organized fashion so that any pertinent part of it might be retrieved at will, and the entire record could be available anywhere in the world where that patient might subsequently have an illness. And of course, if you had all that information available, you would then be able to predict better than we can now the needs of the health service system and would manage the various facilities in order to achieve a high utilization, high efficiency, and a most economical service to our population at risk. Now, that's a rather impressive objective. If you stop and think, and I'm now looking back 10 years and thinking of some of the reasons why those early efforts, you might say, were not entirely successful. Dr. Grossman may comment about that little barb. I think one reason, or the principal reason was, and still is, that the life experience of each one of us as a person encompasses an enormous range of variables, a great many of which bear upon the health or potentially bear upon the health of that individual. And the database that is pertinent to our health ranges all the way from free-form prose, such as I'm using here, and highly quantified data characteristically recorded by numbers, such as input into a health system from clinical laboratories. A full spectrum of human communication. And in the early 60s, no really adequate means for handling any of the input problems in the medical arena. That has become painfully apparent now that this is the principal problem in developing improved communications in the health field. It is the data input problem. We should have known that in 1960 or 1961, but we were so excited about the prospects of plowing ahead that we concentrated on the nature of the communication flow, the interchanges that went on between physicians, paramedicals, and patients, and the institutions in which they worked, and tended to ignore the more mundane problems of inputting the needed information into the system. I think our attitude at that time, toward the medical profession particularly, and I must admit to be a member of that group, was that any group of professionals who were so archaic in their own methods of recording information, mainly the handwritten chronological record, that they must be very ignorant people, or at least people who are oblivious to the progress being made in other fields, so that all we have to do is come in and show them how to do it, and we'll get on with the thing. Now, I too am a bit perplexed as to why the medical profession found itself in this position in 1960. Because by that time, we had already had at least a 30-year experience in using punch card techniques for inputting data and for sorting it and retrieving it. Many of these elementary punch card techniques, which by then had already infiltrated widely into most business activities, most large industries, had had relatively zero impact upon medicine, except in those areas where hospitals were concerned with recording the in and outflow of dollars, where punch card-based accounting systems were moderately well developed. But the medical side of the problem was not developed at all, and in retrospect, it would have been possible in the 50s, in the 40s, and certainly in the 60s, to have developed quantified data systems that pertain to some of the easier problems in the medical arena, such as what patients are in the house, how many beds do you have available, the hotel problem in general, which is certainly one of the problems of managing a hospital. Now, why we did not do this, I do not know. If anything, it's an indictment of the marketing man among you, for here was obviously a fascinating market which was not exploited. But at any rate, in 1960-61, when the push began to get into the modern era, there was very little to base the assault upon. There was very little in the way of well-defined files. Variables were very much free-form, unquantified, and we did not build upon decades of experience of handling information with unit record equipment, such as occurred in the banking industry, insurance industries, and other areas concerned with large files. And it is possible that the absence of all of this did have some impact upon observers from other professions who, witnessing this major lack of development, assumed then that the problem was only because it had been neglected by the physicians and health administrators and could be readily solved if only the right people and the right techniques could be applied. Well, I'm not going to now try to go over the full 10 years of success and failure that has occurred. I think most of you are aware of the fact that major efforts to develop communication systems that would do everything that obviously needs to be done have practically, without exception, failed. Although they have provided useful information, and pieces of them are surviving today and being built upon as we more slowly approach the same goal. At the same time, there were other institutions that did not have major extramural resources and could not, fortunately in many cases for them, attempt an all-at-once solution, which elected to concentrate on the data processing problems, the data collecting problems involved, and have been pecking away at this issue over the last 10 years with some degree of success. Now, before turning to where we are today and looking ahead to the future a little bit, I thought I might mention some of the things that stand out of my own mind as oft-repeated axioms that many of us have accepted as truths, which in retrospect may not have been helpful at all and may actually have been a hindrance. For example, I have often heard it said, do not automate the status quo. The status quo is based upon techniques of a prior era. Don't simply automate a cumbersome, ineffective system, but do it the right way. Do the job once and for all the right way now that you have superior equipment at hand. This is a disastrous principle if one leans upon it too much, because there is a temptation to ignore the quality of the personnel involved, the degree of logical thinking that permeates an institution, and the understanding of the people involved of what their problems really are. I mean by that, if you go into an area where there is utter chaos in a communication arena within a health service facility, your chances of automating anything that will be useful are very, very slim. You cannot automate chaos, and you should not try. But if you do not have some degree of well-developed methods at your disposal, if you are not satisfied that the people who must operate the communication systems understand what their needs are, and are receptive to improve techniques, it is virtually impossible for outsiders to have sufficient understanding and sophistication to come in the midst of chaos and design a useful system that can be implemented and will stand on its own weight on a cost-effective basis once that's done. I know of no major application in the medical area where anybody has come into somebody else's shop with a pre-packaged automation scheme, imposed it upon a group of reluctant managers, inadequately trained personnel, even though they may be working in chaos at the time, with any degree of success. So we have found, looking back now over the 10-year period, that our greatest progress has been made where we can identify some degree of order and some degree of competence, some degree of willingness to understand the need to make things better. We don't necessarily automate exactly the status quo, but unless there is something to build upon, it is virtually impossible to automate anything. And if I could touch on that point with a comment to the marketing people among you, unless you are in a position to attempt to sell to every hospital simultaneously throughout the nation, I would certainly concentrate on those institutions that have some record for progress in this general area of communication. Where you will find the strongest people and the most achievement, you will also often find the greatest opportunity to make either further headway. Another fallacy: doctors are conservative and will resist change. They are going to have to change their ways in order to take advantage of new techniques. They are hopelessly behind the times. We will provide the techniques. It is up to them to change. Now, that type of thinking can lead you to disaster. In a perfect world, your world, that is, and not mine, it might be nice if all the doctors would change and learn to use all the input devices which you are prepared to design for them and sell them. But they are not going to do so unless it makes their job easier and unless it improves the efficiency of use of their time. And this will touch upon Mr. Newman's opening comment, in which he described the disparity between supply and demand. Doctors are conservative, and if you think of what they spend their time doing, I hope you are glad that they are. They are the custodians of the health of people in many respects. They must bear the burden of many unsolvable problems where health cannot be improved or maintained. They are constantly seeking for ways to improve their capacity to do this, but they are not swayed by sales pitches and wild dreams of a better world unless they are convinced that, in fact, things will be better. Now, I have seen in the short period of my participation in this profession, physicians give up an entire lifespan of experience when suddenly new drugs become available on the market and old are thrown out. I went to medical school in the era when syphilis was treated primarily with arsenic compounds. Books were written on this field. They became obsolete almost overnight as penicillin became available. There are repeated episodes of this type of thing, so that to say that the physician is conservative and will not change is not in conformity with observed facts. He probably can throw away an old tool and adopt a new one more quickly than any group I know if he's satisfied and convinced that it will help. Coming now to Mr. Newman's opening comments, as you try to tie these comments into the general theme, then I come to the question, looking both back and forward, will the development of improved systems of communication and automation in our health service facilities help solve this manpower problem? I'm not sure. I am sure that you are going to continue to be part of the problem because you are going to contribute continually, as you have in the past, to improving the technique of medical practice, the scientific application of knowledge to illness. This will continue. This will make medical care more expensive, not less expensive. This may or may not increase the effectiveness of the physician, the chances are it will work in the reverse direction, because as more knowledge becomes available, there are more things the physician needs to do, and you do not solve the labor problem that way. In my own institution, the only area where I have seen to date, after 10 years of effort, any appreciable savings of the doctor's time is in the reporting of clinical laboratory data, which is now entirely reported from computer-based files in an orderly, legible way, so that like variables are columnated by date. And this certainly has saved the doctor's time, saved him from shuffling through large, unorganized chronological files. So I'm hopeful here, but I am unconvinced. I believe, looking ahead a little bit now, that the principal area in which the doctor's time will be saved will be in the accumulation of needed information and its proper organization and proper output format, so that when the doctor sees the patient, he will have all information that it can be predicted he will probably need in that given case. And I hope that some of the following speakers will be in a position to comment upon this. Now, one or two more comments, my time is almost up, about the general environment to set the stage here a little bit. Remember that in this country, by and large, doctors do not work for hospitals. They do in the Veterans Administration, at least they work for a single organization. But in my own institution, which although owned by the Regents of the University of California, operates fully in the private sector, we buy and sell services in the open marketplace, and the doctors who practice medicine there have an independent one-to-one relationship with their patients. I believe as a physician that you, when you are ill, will treasure that type of relationship. Doctors, at least in this society, by and large, do not work for hospitals. Therefore, your hospital director, who will make the decision as to what to buy and what not to buy in his everlasting effort to control his resources and spend the patient's money on those things that will help the patient the most, will be guided by that relationship. He cannot force the physicians to do something that will take more of their time or which they will not be happy with in order to achieve efficiency somewhere else. Any solution to the problem, and primarily it's now the input problem I'm referring to, must be acceptable to the doctor. He must like it. It must save him time. He must find he can do his job better with it than without it. Finally now, just a glance ahead, some of the things that I feel we need very much and that you can help us with. But first, a simple political issue, and maybe you can help here. In order for us to develop integrated medical records so that they can begin to be available wherever patients are, so that records accumulated in one hospital can be quickly merged with those or added to those of another, we need a nationwide unit record numbering system for medical data. We have a Social Security number which appears on our income taxes. The armed forces now use it for patient identification. No doubt many of the industries from which you come do the same. But in the medical arena, to date, this has defied a political solution. One wonders why. It is related, of course, to the concern that political figures have for identifying people with numbers, the concern of the interface between people and machines, and this broad problem that you've heard so much about. We still need improved methods of data input. Much progress has been made, but this is an area that is wide open, in my view, for future development. Hopefully, Dr. Warner Slack will have something to say about this. And we need cheaper hard copy output from files that can be maintained in continuity without out-of-file conditions. I have a lot more I want to say, but there isn't time, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to have to yield to the next speaker.
Thank you, Dr. Lamson. Possibly we can get to some of those other items that you didn't have time for in the question session afterward. I believe I'm going to forego the individual questions after each speaker because I'd like to stay on schedule if we possibly can, and we'll, if you can make a note of your questions and hold them until the last speaker is through, then we'll have a general question session at that time. Michael Crichton, author of Andromeda Strain and The Five Patients, both bestsellers, quotes the next speaker in his book, The Five Patients, as follows, quote, working with computers has made us look closely at how people think. Hopefully, by listening here today to doctors who work with computers, will make us look closely at how doctors that work with computers think. Dr. Jerry Grossman received a BS degree from MIT in 1961 and subsequently did special studies in electrical engineering at MIT and in mathematics at Harvard. He received the medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania in 1965. And since that time, he's been at the Massachusetts General Hospital. In 1969, he was appointed assistant director of the computer science laboratory at the hospital. In 1970, he was appointed assistant director of medical clinics at the hospital. And in 1971, was made an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Grossman will speak on his considerable experience in the development of computer-based medical information systems at Mass General. He has, as Dr. Lamson has, some very definite opinions about what should and should not be done with computers in the hospital setting. And like Dr. Lamson, I'm sure will convey those opinions to us, as I have asked that he do. Dr. Grossman and Dr. Octo Barnett of the Computer Science Lab have developed what they call a basic theology for a realistic approach to the use of computers in medicine. I believe that this theology is a true saying and worthy of all men to be received. I think you will agree, Dr. Grossman.
I hardly think that we're going to hear much in the way of basic truths this morning. I think our experiences at the MGH have made us all very humble. The disasters that Dr. Lamson mentioned, I think, may have begun and been held in their greatest form in our institution. Getting there has not been half the fun, but we've learned a good deal about physicians, and I think we've learned something about engineers as well. As you might note, I have supposedly an engineering background coming from the vocational training school called MIT. I wouldn't want to delude you. I studied American economic history when I was there. So I think that one of the important things is we've heard the medical care crisis characterized today. We need more people. We need more better technology. We've got to save time. We've got to deliver more care. Well, I think that it has much of the flavor that we had in the early 60s about going to the moon, about some of you have worked in defense systems, and there's a marvelous glow to seeing a goal and setting out to reach it and to work together hard and with adequate funds and resources to reach that goal. And I think that, as Dr. Lamson said, in the early 60s, we felt the same way about medicine. The advent of time-shared computer systems and the awakening to our problems in healthcare delivery coalesced into a series of brilliant proposals that we're going to solve everything. We, at our hospital, have the Ether Dome, where ether was first administered in the United States. In 1962, a gentleman from an engineering consulting firm kept the physician spellbound as he portrayed a communication system that would allow all information from every source to be available to a physician just in a moment's notice, that a bibliography of the latest information on any field would be there. And he promised that while this would take time, within 6 months or a year, we would have terminals in every ward in the hospital. And indeed, everyone walked away starry-eyed and began just, you know, making room for the terminals because they'd just, you know, come on in. Well, I think it was 1965, and no one had seen a terminal yet. And people began to get a little bit disconcerted, both in Washington, where they kept sending the checks from, and at the hospital, where these people kept running around with their little pads trying to understand how healthcare is delivered. And I think that an acute care general hospital ward is a rather unique experience for most engineers, or seeing how they work. I think it is best described as a non-system, although in Europe they are affectionately called the American healthcare delivery system an anti-system. And what we found in our early years were the engineers were saying, my God, how can you possibly operate up here? Now, let us just show you how to clean all of this away, and you know, we understand what to do. Well, the way a hospital works is such that you don't have very many hours if this doesn't work to try it again. There is a tremendous sense of urgency in day-to-day operations in hospitals. And so that the understanding and the ability to deliver service in a hospital has to be on a minute-to-minute basis and has to indeed not take up the resources of those people working on the wards. As you know, I'm sure you've been led to understand everyone in hospitals is overworked, underpaid, they don't get enough sleep. Well, they're not going to have a chance to take an hour to sit down and chat with you about how they work or what they want to do or what they think is the right way to work it. And so we had the growing communication gap between the engineers who wanted your time and who wanted to tell you what they were going to do for you and the, you know, and the promises they made to you, and you were sitting there saying, I haven't got time for anything, and what you do give me doesn't work. And in those early years, and I think even now, computer system reliability is not at all thought of, doesn't meet the requirements of medical care institutions, especially, you know, acute care hospitals. They can't tolerate a few hours of downtime. We'll surely be up tomorrow. You know, that's just not going to work. Yet that was exactly what was going on, and this led us to a real standoff between the engineers and the medical staff. So in 1965, the hospital and the NIH got together and decided they had to bring in some interface people, you know, the famous interface people. And that's where we came in, that, you know, we cloaked in our engineering and medical backgrounds, we arrived to speak to with both faces. And indeed, I think we did quite seriously look at the problems that occurred and had occurred in the past. And I think one of the most important things we had to do was to become much more realistic about our goals, reassess our aspirations. And I think that the result was we came to understand that most of the problems that we would have to deal with in the early years were quite pedestrian, that the change they would bring to medical care or physician efficiency were not going to be very noticeable, that we had a great deal to learn, and that we had to work with projects that were appropriate, if not quote-unquote exciting. And as Dr. Lamson mentioned, there were patient census systems or clinical laboratory test reporting. Well, they were very hard projects, and they took a great deal of time and effort, and they didn't make a big splash in medical care. And I think it was very hard for those of us working to scale down our ambitions and to get the people we work with to accept these scaled down goals and ambitions. And I am fearful that many people still have beautiful and grandiose goals of what can be done and at what rate. We don't know, I don't think. I think as the learning curve is very steep. As we solve one problem, our solution to the next one may look very different. And so that I think it's important for us all to recognize that the progress we will make is very slow, and that things we did yesterday we may have to throw out tomorrow, but that we have to accept that we have a lot of work to develop a database and experience in working in human systems. I think that one, we are going to need you, and you are going to need us in the years to come. Medicine will have to undergo organizational change, because I don't think it's technology that's going to provide care to more people at less expense. It's going to be better organization and better management. Better management is the result of better information on which to base management decisions. The medical information is the data you need to make those decisions. So it will be an important byproduct, but it hardly will spell the difference. And I think that, so the first thing is that we have to work on problems that are mundane, that are small, that are circumscribed, and we have to accept that physicians and engineers do not necessarily see eye to eye. I think there is a certain arrogance in both groups in believing they know the right way to do it. I think the second thing that we have to be willing to do is to provide very, very reliable service. We've got to back up our promises with delivery. Once again, small problems help us do that. If we can move in a modular, stepwise, evolutionary approach, and we can use this in computer systems as well. One of the decisions we made, which has worked pretty well for us, is rather than the gargantuan computer, if a smaller computer doesn't work, get a bigger one. You know, I'm sure many of you who are with manufacturers understand that principle. But what we said was reliability was the principal element. We had to prove to the medical profession that we could do what we said. We had to be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So what we've chosen to do at the MGH is to have a series of moderate-sized computers so that one serves as backup for the other. And so that should a system fail, we can come up within minutes with the next one. And as a result, we have what we affectionately call a gaggle of PDP-9s, or a herd, or whatever you'd like. As we introduce each service, we make a service module, and we reserve one as for research and development and backup. And as we fill that machine, we add a second one for the next set of services. And that way, we are able to grow in a somewhat economically viable way, and yet always able to deliver viable and reliable service to the hospital. And it has been abundantly clear, as we've continued to prove to them that we're there every day continually, they're more willing to entrust us with more critical problems, so that there is indeed a long period of trust building. Along with moderate-sized computers, there is the need to be responsive to changes in the system and changes which people request. One of our earlier problems was we wrote everything in assembly language. Well, that was lovely. You know, I'd like to move this over to the left-hand side of the page. Well, I'll be back to you in 3 months, and I'm sure we can get it done with very well. And, you know, people just didn't find that very acceptable. So then one goes on to higher-level languages. And I think that we have found that we felt the need to develop our own language that was particularly oriented around the file structure and the file handling of patient records, and that was particularly oriented around text material, because the principal data in a patient's record is text, or if it is numerical, it's still not very little computation is done on that data. So we went on to develop our own computer language that was a higher level interpretive language that allowed our programmers to institute changes very rapidly. Indeed, now we're able to work with our physician colleagues in a manner so that when they ask for something, we can give them a rapid turnaround time. They're very impatient, let me assure you. And that's a fact of life. They haven't got time to wait. They'll lose interest. There are many other things that are important to them. So that one has to be prepared to be quite responsive in developing the programs and projects that you're working on. And I think the third thing is that what Dr. Lamson alluded to, there's little question that we cannot prove the economics of computers at this point. We're not going to be able to sell them to institutions because they're going to save them money or time at this point. One has to be prepared to deal with them because they're necessary. One of the things that I think is that institutions are going to need to use computation and computer-based systems simply because the volume of data is increasing at such a rate, paper systems are just not functional, so that they will be forced to come to you and to make some changes that will allow them just to continue to operate. I think that the point that is most important is that you and the physicians, we as a group, must be willing to be patient and understanding with one another, and to accept that we are going to be working on quite straightforward problems that probably the physicians will have to make many basic decisions about, the way they run their lives. And one of the things, we ran a two-day seminar for engineers at MIT this spring, and it turned out that there was a constant undertone of engineers who had worked with physicians and were angry and frustrated and felt that physicians were not responsive to their capabilities. And the one most successful engineer said that he had to accept that he had to subjugate his own personality and his own leadership within the medical institution in order to get things done. He worked through the physicians in getting projects underway. And I don't say this is good, I don't say this is right, but I do think at this particular juncture in time, one, it is necessary for those of us who are doing engineering and using computers to build our credibility with the profession. And I think it has begun, to be sure, but there's still a great distance to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. There are some chairs over on this side of the room, unless you're wanting to stand by the door to make a quick getaway, and if you'd like to sit down, I think if you'll file around the back, there are plenty of seats over here. Probably be more comfortable. Both Dr. Lamson and Dr. Grossman have referred to the importance of the data input problem in the medical setting. The next speaker has a long association with that problem and will be addressing it for us today. I first became aware of Dr. Werner Schlack's work in his work with automating the medical history when he was at the University of Wisconsin. I later was privileged to hear him speak on this and related subjects at the AMA convention on computers in medicine, and have continued to follow his work on the ambulatory care project with Lincoln Lab and Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. Dr. Schlack received the AB degree in biology at Princeton and his doctorate at Columbia. Until 1970, he was an assistant professor of medicine and computer science at University of Wisconsin, and recently was appointed as assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and an associate in medicine at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. He will speak to us on this particularly critical aspect of medical information system data input, the man-computer interface problem. And as has been referred to, it can be and is a critical bottleneck. Dr. Slack.
Thank you very much, Temple. This sort of is starting to take on some of the characteristics of awake. I mean, this, and I'm going to add my two cents worth too. Actually, I do think that in the field of computer medicine, prophecy has at least sometimes been a substitute for accomplishment. And quite frankly, there are not an awful lot of sick people in our country who have benefited much from computers to date. Excepting perhaps by getting their bill a little earlier, as Baldwin pointed out, which from the patient's vantage point I think is of moot value, if not the hospital's. I think that, on the other hand, this is not necessarily grounds for pessimism. The computer is a mind-expanding device, and there's a tendency with it to want to go to the stars, really, before crossing the street. And what I think we're doing now is sort of settling down with a very interesting and potentially powerful machine and trying to come up with some ideas on how best to use it. In the early days, and I think the vendors have to assume a little of the responsibility for this, in the early days of computers and medicine, the concept was perpetrated that the mere presence of a machine would result in good things. And a fair number of hospital superintendents got burned very badly. They bought their monolith and plunked it down in the hospital and expected automatically overnight good things to accrue, and of course they didn't. And a lot of money was lost and a lot of tempers flared and there were a lot of difficulties. But this is not to say that the potential of the computer in medicine is not great. I think it is great, but I think it will take time. And I don't think that the analogy, I don't think we're in a Manhattan Project type situation or even a moon type situation. I think that we need ideas, good ideas, and just getting people together with varied and interesting backgrounds is not necessarily going to result in good things. We need good ideas and a lot of time and a lot of hard work, and I think that there is really room for optimism. Priorities are very important here, I think. For example, it may be possible to build a billion-dollar computer-based system which can interpret chest x-rays. May be possible. On the other hand, if we could break down some of the professionalism and some of the barriers within the medical profession and admit that perhaps a high school graduate or a grade school graduate, for that matter, could, with his fabulous pattern recognizer of the brain, sit before a machine and pick out dark from light and do a very good job very quickly, this might be a much more efficient system. There are things like this, and there are analogies here in the teaching machine business, too. A lot of teaching machines and some things in medicine really are sort of one sits before a very expensive interactive device and reads page after page. Well, the oppositional thumb is a very reliable page turner, and it's been with us a long time, and it's very inexpensive. Well, with these things in mind, I would like to talk very briefly about some of the work that we have been doing at the University of Wisconsin and more recently in Boston with the use of a computer as an interactive device for collecting medical history information from patients. The rationale behind this work was that, let me back up for a second. In the early days of computer medicine, there was a lot of emphasis on the trickiness of the diagnostic decision-making process, and people were interested in computer diagnosis and using all sorts of mathematical techniques and arriving at diagnostic decision-making algorithms, things of this order, which are interesting and have great potential, I think. On the other hand, and I'm really concurring with what Dr. Lampson said earlier, the real bottleneck in clinical medicine is not the diagnostic decision-making process nearly so much as it is the data collection process. If a physician is presented with a cogent statement of the medical background of a patient, he may be able to put this together diagnostically very quickly, in a matter of seconds or minutes. But asking 300 or 400 questions of a patient in the process is a very time-consuming situation. And now it was with this in mind that we decided to tackle the problem of the medical history. And there had been work done with self-administered questionnaires, and these the self-administered with a patient administering this to himself, checking in the yes or no box depending upon his answer. Cornell Medical Index is the first example of this. A powerful device and being used well today in the hands of people like Dr. Grossman at the Harvard Community Health Plan and Dr. Collin at the Kaiser Permanente Hospitals and in many other places throughout our country. And self-administered questionnaires overcome such problems as the long time it takes a doctor to ask questions and the expense of physician-patient interaction. Talk is not cheap in medicine. It's perhaps the most expensive commodity in the clinical process. And if you examine psychiatry, where talk is, at least in many instances, the only commodity, and the going rates are in the range of $40, $50 an hour, you get some idea as to the full how expensive professional talk is when the client is paying for this. And the self-administered questionnaire is an economical device to administer. And of course, very important is the fact that it's standardized. The responses are in a known location available for quick retrieval and use, both in patient care and clinical research. But it was our thought that perhaps by interfacing a patient with a computer, we might be able to model some of the advantages that the physician or the human interviewer has going for him, namely the ability to qualify items in detail, to branch, to adapt one's history, to individualize it to the particular needs of the patient. And that we might also be able to utilize some of the psychological controls that a physician utilizes. When a patient doesn't understand, a physician can explain. We might be able to incorporate that into the system, to use words of encouragement en route through the process, to make satisfactory completion of a potentially very detailed history more likely with the use of reinforcement techniques. It was with these thoughts in mind that we programmed a very small computer, the laboratory instrument computer, a standalone device that we had available to us back in 1964 with a small cathode ray tube on this on the console. We programmed this to interview patients with regard to their allergy symptoms. May I have the first slide, please? This is a later version of the link, but the questions appeared on the screen, and we used the magnetic tape as auxiliary storage because this computer had a very small memory. I might say that at the time that we first started this work, the small standalone computer was the only thing available to us. We were advised to wait for the Burroughs 8500 terminals. I'm still waiting. And we had a few political hassles in conjunction with that in Madison, but we were able to get our own small machine and press on with our research. And it turned out to be a very nice device for testing the computer as a medical history collector. Now, the next slide, please. And more recently, we have, in Madison, programmed a small computer. Now it would be a PDP-12, which is connected by a buffer display system to three standard television CRTs. And computer-based patient interviewing is in routine use now at the University of Wisconsin hospitals, both in the outpatient clinic and on a general medical ward. Now the next slide, please. And this just a patient interacting. Next slide, please. Very briefly, old slide demonstrating the early branching logic of our system. Have you ever had hives? If no, out to the next question. If yes, do you have any idea what caused your hives? And then on to questions concerning association with specific causes of hives, and then other questions about frequency, medical care, things of that order. If the patient did not understand or didn't know the answer, we would branch out, explain to him the meaning, reword the question, come back, make comprehension more likely. And we began to incorporate computer instruction techniques into the system. When a patient didn't understand the meaning, we would actually teach him using computer-based instruction. We've also incorporated a fifth response for the patient to overcome the assumption the patient is, in fact, willing to answer. We start out with it as none of your damn business. We've now toned it down to skip it. And it's it's not used very often, but it's obvious that its presence is appreciated. I say that on the basis of the gusto with which people press it when they do, in fact, use it. As a matter of fact, I don't think that people should be forced to answer any question they don't want to. In medicine and almost all types of interviewing, We just assume that the client should answer, and if he balks or something, we use circuitous methods, devious tricks to try and get information from him. After all, it is his information, it's his life, it's his health status, and I think it should be, we should work very hard to make it clear to the patient why, in fact, we're asking the question. And I must say as an aside that well over 50% of the questions in our medical history, and I think most medical histories, are of moot value. We don't really know the meaning of the medical history as it's traditionally taken. But insofar as we do know why we're asking the questions, we ought to explain this to the patient and then let him decide whether or not he cares to answer. And we've begun to do this. If a patient says skip it with regard to a question, we'll now explain. We're asking this because sometimes it may be of help to you and think, do you still want to skip it? And if he says yes, fine. Next slide, please. Very briefly, a section from the habits section of our general medical history. Have you ever smoked tobacco? If no, a little positive reinforcement, good for you. Cigarettes in particular can be bad for your health. Please press go to continue. If he is a smoker, now we have a little instructional system in there which tells him about some of the dangers he may be subjecting himself to in conjunction with a tobacco habit, and some of the data and things of that order, with the hope of discouraging him, but once again, obviously, it's his decision. Then on to a fairly detailed history of tobacco consumption, and then finally out to the next habits question, which has to do with alcohol. And perhaps due to the biases of the writer, namely myself, the computer is a good bit more gentle on the drinker than it is on the smoker. May I have the next slide, please? We are working, by the way, on an automated tobacco clinic, and we're also working on an automated overweight clinic, such that in an interactive manner, the computer will be able to collect information from the patient who is anxious to lose weight, help him with diet planning, and give him back information and so forth, and perhaps in an interactive manner be of some service to the patient. This is a cluttered slide, but very briefly, it gives the general logic of a chest pain history, which might be looked upon as one attribute. If he says yes to chest pain, on to a bunch of questions about which side it's on, whether it's sharp or dull or aching, whether it comes on with exertion and is relieved by rest. We're trying to get at the type of chest pain which is caused by insufficiency of the blood supply to the cardiac muscle. If initially the answer is no to chest pain, the patient skips all of this. Next slide, please. And this is an example of a frame on our new TV sets in Madison. One of the uses of computer instruction, in addition to explaining the meaning of items to patients, has been to teach them how to use the computer. And it gives us a nice control over the situation, because before the patient is permitted to answer the first medically relevant question, he must have satisfied our criteria of mastery of the system. And so we know, for example, before we present the first medical question to him, that he can read, that he can maintain sustained mental activity, that he is, in fact, alert and oriented in all spheres. It is, in fact, sort of a mental status examination on the way. And we certainly don't want the the computer interview to be trivial. Some people who have done computer-based interviewing recently have been concerned about the full typewriter keyboard, which we used in our early work, and have put big buttons on the side and things like that. Actually, I don't want a patient with clonus, which is an abnormality like this, to be able to go through an interview without really imparting any information to the system. And the fact that a patient can select five keys from a relatively common ensemble of keys on a keyboard implies to us that he is probably in a good situation to answer the medical question. Next slide, please. If he presses the go bar, the computer says, very good, you can answer yes to a question by pressing key number one and then the go bar, try it. There's some self-instructional frames. If he does it right, next slide, please. Exactly. You can answer no to a question by pressing key number two and then the go bar, try it. If he makes a mistake here, next slide, please. Please call Mrs. Spencer for some help. Mrs. Spencer is the human being in the loop who is waiting around the corner, available for consultation at any time. Certainly, if a patient is illiterate or has very bad eyesight or is blind, be unable to interact directly with a machine, and an attendant will be necessary. We have had junior high school students who have volunteered to help us do the reading, sometimes patients' family members, things of this order, or perhaps an assistant like Mrs. Spencer. On the other hand, I think that when a patient is capable of reading for themselves, it's very important that they do it. In the first place, it keeps one extra set of variables from the system, less noise in the system, and also it's far less expensive. Next slide, please. Just a joke question. Are you having fun, getting tired, and so forth, getting mad or scared of the machine? Next slide, please. If they're having fun, I'm very glad to hear that. Shall we continue? If they're getting tired or scared of the machine, they're asked, of course, to call Mrs. Spencer again. We have put a little bit of humor into our system. This is sort of, it turns out to be a controversial subject, I guess, as to whether or not it should be humorous. I think that it's actually terrible the way in which the traditional medical situation where it's supposed to be no fun at all to be a patient under any circumstances. I think it's a throwback to the days when disease was associated with being possessed by the devil or something like that. But it's a very rare hospital, has nice walls and good art on the wall and some music in and things of that order. Well, we're very anxious for our system to be fun for people and interesting for them as well as a potential help to them medically. And so we play around with a few little throwaway lines and things like that. At the University of Wisconsin, which as you know is a somewhat activistic school, we asked people early in the game, particularly in our student health clinic, are you a student here at the University of Wisconsin? They said yes. The machine would say right on and power to the people, which seemed to establish very quick rapport and worked very well. Now the next slide, please. Now in one or two words with the letter keys, type what brings you to the university hospitals here. They can type in their chief complaint. One quick aside, what we were doing is just taking the input and then on the printed summary which the computer generates, we would have chief complaint and then just throw back what they had said. Well, one of our very first patients typed in, my wife brings me to the hospital. So that came out as chief complaint. Well, we had to change that fairly quickly. May I have the next slide, please? A summary, a standard summary of our general medical history in traditional format of social history, family history, habits, and then the review of systems. Next slide, please. Generated upon completion of the interview. Now, this just demonstrates some of the potential of the computer as an educator of patients. In this case, if the patient does not understand the concept of electrocardiography, the computer will teach him and it'll be a little test before the question is re-presented. Next slide, please. And something that we're becoming even more interested in now is the use of the computer as an instructor to improve the patient's knowledge of health matters of relevance to him in a general sense. We're learning a lot about a patient en route through the interview, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to turn right around and fill in important ignorance gaps. And doctors are terrible teachers. Generally speaking, it's a didactic presentation of information. The doctor does not want to embarrass the patient by implying he doesn't think the patient is understanding. The patient, in turn, does not want to look ignorant, so he hesitates to ask questions. And very often, even simple things like how to take the pills is not communicated to patients. Intelligent, bright people and so forth who are taking their medications wrongly because of miscommunication. I think that patient education could be particularly useful on an inpatient basis. The patient's time while he's in the hospital bed is notoriously wasted. He waits all day for the 5 minutes while he talks to his doctor, and the rest of the time is spent in a very regressive type situation. He's not shown what he's taking. He's forced into a very infantile role. And then at the time of discharge, he's given 15 bottles and some illegible notes and sent on his way. Well, we ought to be able to use that inpatient time to prepare the patient for his outpatient existence. And I have hopes for computer educational techniques as one mechanism for doing that. Thus far, our experience has been quite limited. This case, we did a short course on hay fever for patients. Allergic rhinitis is just the medical term for hay fever. Would you like to know something more about hay fever? If patients said yes, which most everybody did, we would teach them about hay fever in Wisconsin, how to avoid certain pollens, things of that order. And the course was very well received. Next slide, please. Now, one of our early concerns with regard to the system was what patient's reaction would be to it. And when people have not heard of, when the concept of computer interviewing is first presented to many people, one of the first criticisms that comes into their mind is patient acceptance. Will patients permit themselves to be interviewed by a machine which is performing a function traditionally in the province of the physician? Well, our experience has been very, very favorable in this respect. Patients have liked it. They indicate that they one is yes, two is no, three is don't know, and four don't understand. And you can see that most everyone has found it interesting, non-boring, not tiring. And others who have done the experiment have corroborated our early results, Dr. John Main at the Mayo Clinic, people at the Mass General Hospital, and so forth. It is a positive experience, generally, for patients. And just for the fun of it, when we put in questions with regard to preference of machine versus doctor and so forth, it was interesting. Everything gets sort of muddled. The computer's coming out a little bit ahead here. Obviously, if the doctor were asking the patient, I suspect the doctor would be coming out ahead. And we have a little data to show that, because sometimes people say, yes, they prefer the doctor, and yes, they prefer the machine, not wanting to hurt either's feelings. Be that as it may, and granting this is very soft data, we have the Hawthorne effect operating, the tendency of people to react on, to support an experimental situation in which they're participating and so forth. All of that is going, and the data are very soft, but at least the data tend to show that it is not a negative situation for people. Next slide, please. One of the criticisms of computer interviewing as we have been doing it in the past has been the insensitivity of the machine to nonverbal information, which perhaps physicians use to advantage. I say perhaps because the data are very scarce in terms of nonverbal cues. By that I mean gesticulations, intonation of voice, facial expression, motions, pauses, things of that order. Well, it's been our hypothesis that insofar as we could measure nonverbal information, we ought to be able to deal with it. And we have written a program for the PDP-12 which monitors heart rate and, more recently, respirations and response latency, the time between the presentation of a frame and the making of a keyboard response, and records this information for each frame. And in addition, the program has the capability of using this nonverbal information as contingencies for branching. For example, if 15 seconds or some other time, some other latency has elapsed, if there's a question frame to be or an explanatory frame to be presented to the patient contingent upon latency, the computer can go out and do that. And in like manner, if the heart rate is above a certain point or below or whatever, the computer could go out and say, for example, tell the patient to relax, to wait a minute, things of that order. I don't know how useful this will be now, but it does open up a new area of study for us, and we might find that there's an association between prolonged response latencies and the reliability with which a person responds to questions. Things of relevance to a person, like suicidal thoughts, perhaps might be associated with a rapid heart rate, so forth. It might be useful. And at least we're in a position now to study the situation, which doctors in the past, in the usual interviewing situation, have not. Next slide, please. And this is just a printed summary. As a matter of fact, we can have the lights now. I think my time is up. I might, in 10 seconds, say that one further project that we've been working on at the Beth Israel Hospital in conjunction with the MIT Lincoln Lab has been the use of the computer as a data collector with an aide or a patient's assistant interacting with a terminal on the patient to collect information from patients with chronic diseases, specifically diabetes and hypertension, with the hope that we'll be able to save physicians' visits in the system. In other words, the computer collects information of relevance to diabetes, and then we have referral criteria built into the system. And if it's decided that the patient is under good diabetic control at this particular time, he will not have to see a physician. If, on the other hand, we detect abnormalities, then he would see a physician. And we hope, with techniques like this, to reduce the number of necessary physician-patient encounters and thereby save time in the congested outpatient situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Slack. We do still have a few chairs on the other side of the room if you'd like to be seated for the last speaker. Well, as if the subject matter that we have been covering here today isn't broad enough, we felt that there was one more area that absolutely had to be discussed, and we have an extremely qualified individual to do that for us, and that is the question of the legal implications of the medical data. Dr. Gampel will speak to us on this subject. Dr. Gampel has a particularly interesting background. He's a graduate in medicine from the University of Manchester in England. He's a member of the AMA and the California Medical Association and has been in the private practice of medicine in California. In the 1950s, because everything that had to be done in medicine had already been done, Dr. Gampel was therefore not challenged any longer by that field and decided to take part in another. And so doing, went to Stanford and obtained the Juris Doctor degree. He is now a lecturer in law at Stanford University. He's a member of the California Bar and the American Trial Lawyers Association, and is also in the private practice of law in San Jose. Dr. Gampel will speak to us on the legal implications of medical data. Dr. Gampel.
Thank you very much, Temple. As the last speaker, I've always reminded of the biblical aphorism that the last shall be first, the first shall be last, and all shall be confusion. I must be the only person here that doesn't even know what a computer is. But I've seen one in operation. I went to the El Camino Hospital, which, as some of you may know, it's in Mountain View here in Northern California, and is a recipient of untold millions of, I think, federal funds and the beneficence of the Lockheed Corporation and, or maybe it's the Technicon company. And it's got a new computer thing for medicine. And I got somebody to show it me, and it is utterly and unbelievably fascinating. I sat and watched this thing almost for hours. And I'll tell you what I saw it do. You go along and, as a physician, you go in and you press some letters, and that's your code number. And immediately on the screen comes all the patients you've got in the hospital. You take a light pen and you touch one, and that patient's name then comes at the top of the screen. And then you want to have some test, so you press a thing that says X-ray, or you point with your light pen. And then comes all the common X-ray things, what parts of the body, and you pick, say, gastrointestinal tract, and up comes all those X-rays, and then you press upper GI series. And at that moment, lights flash and it goes tilt, and you've ordered an upper GI series on this particular patient. And as I understand, at that moment, there are printouts. If you must forgive me if I have the jargon wrongly. It prints out in the X-ray department that Mr. Schmo is to have an upper GI series, and it prints out in the pharmacy what they have to do, and it tells the nurse that he's not to have anything to eat after midnight. And most important of all, it bills it on the accounts receivable. Well, I thought this was unbelievably fascinating. I have to say that it only seemed to me like a glorified pneumatic tube, but maybe that's what computers are. That's what I know about it. Well, now I want to tell you about a lawsuit, which is something I really know something about. It's the case of a recent California case, maybe 6 months ago, of In re Lifshitz. And Dr. Lifshitz is a psychiatrist. And Dr. Lifshitz had a patient who teaches in a school, in a high school. And some student got into an altercation with his teacher, and he creamed him. And thereupon, the teacher sued the student for assault and battery, and alleged that this assault on him, battery on him, had caused him sickness in his mind and body. Those are almost formal words that you write in. If you get rear-ended, I will allege that you have been made sick in your mind and body. But along comes the defense lawyer, as he is allowed to do, and sends certain written requests for information to the plaintiff, the school teacher. Have you ever had any mind sicknesses before? After all, you can't obtain damages from this wretched student if you, in fact, had the condition previously. And it became apparent that this plaintiff, this teacher, had previously been treated by Dr. Lifshitz, the psychiatrist. Now, you may be aware of a thing called the doctor-patient privilege, which means that if you have been to see a doctor previously, your communications, both the oral or written communications, as well as the doctor's impressions and diagnoses of you, are confidential. There's a good deal of historical reason for that. Maybe you will unburden your soul to the doctor. You will tell him things that you wouldn't tell to other people, with the aim that he will obtain a better reading of what's the matter with you. And it is thought that if you had looming over you the idea that this communication could be published to third parties, that you would be more reluctant to communicate to your innermost thoughts to your doctor, and therefore your medical help that you require would be to some extent less freely available. However, there is another axiom of the law that if you bring a lawsuit alleging personal injury, that the very bringing of the lawsuit, to use the legalese, waives the privilege. After all, it would seem basically unfair that you claim certain injuries and nobody can ever find whether or not you had the injuries before, that nobody can ever query your previous medical record. So, as the law allows, certain subpoenas were addressed to Dr. Lifshitz, saying, did you ever treat Mr. Plaintiff before? And if so, what was the matter with him? What did he tell you? And in effect, they didn't ask that. They said, send your records to be copied. Absolutely legal. Dr. Lifshitz refused. This is a sin against the Holy Ghost. You don't... You do not lightly refuse subpoenas from lawyers.